Let's reconnect with the motivation. Just noticing there are many, many other choices we could have made for how to spend this Sunday together, or spend this Sunday. And somehow the conditions came together for us to have the opportunity to do it together. Just spend some time reflecting on compassion. Spend some time reflecting on our own inner world and what really makes us happy. What really causes our difficulties? It's the kind of examination that is rather rare in the world, actually. So we can rejoice in having that interest, rejoice in having the opportunity, having a place to come where there are like-minded people to share and explore together. And if we think about it at all, we can recognize it by cultivating our own loving kindness, our own compassion. It immediately benefits the people around us. So it's not just for ourselves that we're here. And we can stretch our mind a little bit further to really set the intention that by sharing the Dharma, sharing the Buddha's teachings together, especially reflecting on the causes of compassion and how it works in our life, thinking about how to develop it in ourselves and grow it, expand it, that through the ripple effect, ultimately every living being will benefit from this. So let's set that as our motivation this morning. So our founder and teacher, who's usually giving this talk, Venerable Thupten Chodron, is probably packing her suitcase right now, leaving Moscow. She's been on a teaching tour. Did she leave the very day of sharing the Dharma Day last time? Yeah, so we had a few days, but she's been gone about a month, teaching first in the East Coast and then to Italy, then to Germany, and now she's been in Moscow for the last 8 days, I think, or maybe longer. She'll be back tomorrow. So in the meantime, we carry on in her stead. That's what she trains us to do. So we've been just started a new book for our Sharing the Dharma Day themes, An Open-Hearted Life. And for the last over 2 years, we've been sharing this book, exploring it together at the Spokane, the Buddhist meditation class at the Spokane Unitarian Church. So many of us who have gone and led those classes are very familiar with this book. We can make a huge testimonial about the value of this book. It's written by our teacher and also by Dr. Russell Coltz, who's a professor at Eastern Washington University. He focuses on what is called compassion-focused therapy. And so the book is really a workbook. Very short little chapters, step by step by step with exercises, looking at cultivating compassion, how to do it, what are the obstacles, why to do it, ways to think about it, coming at it both from the Buddhist perspective and from the psychology perspective. So the combination is very interesting and very helpful. So I heartily recommend it. So this year we finished the last book that we did for, I don't know, a few years for Sharing the Dharma Day. And Venerable Chodron said, well, let's do this one. So she gave the first talk last time, drawing from the preface that was written by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So this time I'm going to do the preface. There's two prefaces, one from the psychology point of view and one from the Buddhist point of view. So she got the Dalai Lama, of course, but I thought it would be only fair to go back and start from the preface that was written by the psychologist. So that's what we're going to do this morning. The person who wrote this, the preface writer, is Dr. Russell Coltz's mentor. His name is Professor Paul Gilbert, OBE. That means Order of the British Empire, I believe, right? Do we have any Brit? Yeah, OBE. So he is a founder of, he's a professor of clinical psychologist at the University of Derby, consultant clinical psychologist at the Derbyshire Healthcare Foundation. He established what he called the Compassionate Mind Foundation, and he is really the founder of this compassion-focused therapy approach. And that's why he got his Order of the British Empire. Knighting. I've never met him, of course, but to hear Russell Colts talk about this professor, he's very, very fond and respectful of this man. And his movement of compassion-focused therapy has really, I think, is starting to have quite an impact on Western psychology in general. So he has some interesting things to say about compassion in his preface of the book. I'll do what Venerable Chödrön did. I'll read a little bit, and then we'll comment and open up this book together. So he says, Western psychology has focused on the scientific study of mind and to a large extent, the individual. Now, I will make a little comment here. I don't know how much scientific study of the mind has gone on. The brain, yes. And I suppose from a psychological point of view, there has been a lot of study about, you know, cause and effect and what makes people tick and, I don't know, more on mental health side. Venerable Jigme would know really more about this than I do, lots more. So I think it's an interesting statement, but we'll buy it. Western psychology is focused on the scientific study of mind and to a large extent, the individual. This, he says, is true. It has concentrated on mental health problems, aggression, assertiveness, self-esteem, how to compete better in the world, how to have better bodies and better sex. True. In fact, there is increasing evidence that over the last 30 years, we have become more self-focused, grasping, and narcissistic, increasingly preoccupied with our sense of self and our self-presentation, whether in the real world of working or dating or social media. Would you concur? More self-obsessed, more self-preoccupied. And I think his point here is that the study of mind hasn't necessarily made us broader minded. It's just made us more focused on grasping, narcissism, our sense of self, and so forth. The consequences, this is good. We have turned into theatrical performers, riddled with self-criticism and shame, fearful of rejection if our performance does not win the approval of others. Ring a bell? How many off? I mean, I can totally resonate with this. How many of us are totally measure ourselves against the reflection we get back from people? You know, how am I doing? Am I okay? Am I okay? Am I okay? Am I, oh, you tell me I'm okay? Great. You tell me I'm not okay? Devastation. Right? Wow. That barometer is off. Unfortunately, the consequence of our material wealth and do more, have more, be more attitudes is not always greater happiness. I would say is never greater happiness. Do you think? Do more, be more, have more, do more, be more, have more, never. And in fact, the increased risk of depression and anxiety is increasing, especially among young people. Statistically, we can see that. Yeah, the rate of suicide is just rising, rising, rising. So then his introduction to the book then is what happens when we turn this on its head? So that it's not so much self-enhancement that is the key to happiness, but compassion. The wish to open to the suffering of self and others with a commitment to try to engage with it, alleviate, and prevent it. So he doesn't define compassion very clearly here, but they do a little bit later in the book. Compassion is based on the desire for others to be free from suffering and the aspiration to help alleviate that suffering. Does that resonate with your view of what you think compassion is? Yeah. Compassion is based on the desire for others to be free from suffering and the aspiration to help alleviate that suffering. And there are many reasons to cultivate that compassion. But I wanted to look at this word suffering. You know, with our go for it, do better, succeed, 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 succeed kind of culture, life is good. You know, that's the catchphrase of our time, right? Life is good. You may be in hell. Your life may be a wreck, but you see somebody, you shake their hand, yeah, life is good. And we have this idea that life should be that way. Some years ago now, we were giving a talk before we got to this book at the Spokane UU, and a gentleman had been coming, he was well into his 80s too, I think. He'd been coming for a long time to the talks. And at one point he raised his hand and he said, you know, I just don't get the suffering thing. So my life is fine. I see it around me. You know, he had been in a caring profession. He said, I see it with the people that I've worked with my whole life. But he said, this just doesn't work for me, this suffering business. So I think that as we begin to study compassion, we have to start at understanding what does it mean? If compassion is the relief of suffering, what does that mean? So Venerable Children also often talks about the Sanskrit word that the Buddha expressed when he was talking about this in the very beginnings of his teachings is dukkha. Depending on whether it's Sanskrit or Pali, it's spelled a little bit differently, but basically it's something like D-U-H-K-H-A, dukkha. The translation is not so much suffering, anguish, although that's a part of it, but it has more to do with unsatisfactoriness. Things are not satisfactory. And just as living beings, this is universal, animals have the same thing, that we're constantly trying to overcome that unsatisfactoriness to get a little bit of pleasure. Just a little bit. We're happy with just a little bit for a few minutes. But that's the driving force. We want to be happy. We want to be happy. We want to be happy. Give me a little pleasure. We want to be happy. 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 And anything that's in the way of that, anything that thwarts our attempts to get that bit of pleasure or to be happy, then brings on a reaction of aversion. So we don't want any kind of difficulty, any challenge, any hassle. And, you know, we can be very sensitive to the littlest bit of the thwarting of happiness. And our minds just dive. Pew! Have you ever had that experience where you wake up, the day is beautiful, you walk out, breakfast is bad. Boom, down we go. Somebody comes in and says something nice to you. Oh, I'm back up again. Off to work we go. Oh, the car doesn't work. Boom, devastation. Now I'm late. I'm going to go to work. Somebody is going to I'm going to get in trouble for not being at work. Miserable, 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 miserable. The boss comes in and says, oh, you know, it's really okay. You didn't have to be here until 10 o'clock this morning anyway. Oh, relief. I'm fine. Somebody brought in donuts. That's great. I ate four. Now I'm going to puke. Oh, I'm down in the hole again. All day long. We are like this, trying to be happy and responding to the external environment. So that, and as Venerable Sankhya just said, that's dukkha. That's dukkha. And, you know, the more we think about it, I think there's a little bit of a, like, who wants to believe that? Are you sure there's no happiness in those donuts? There's no happiness there? Are you positive there is no happiness in those donuts? Let me try another and see. No, that was pretty good. Let me try another and see. You know, 2 hours later, you're either fast asleep or, you know, however this affects you. It doesn't work. But somehow our mechanism internally doesn't get that it doesn't work. And so because we think we should be happy, we should be. Because we think we know what will make us happy, we're into this go get it, strive, get ahead, get my thing, and nobody's happiness is more important than mine. And that just perpetuates all of our unsatisfactoriness and sometimes our gross, painful suffering. And we can't get it out of our head. This should make me happy. This career should make me happy. This marriage should make me happy. This friendship should make me happy. This walk in the garden should make me happy. This walk in the forest. I came back with four ticks last night. should make me happy. We can't somehow in our everyday thinking, we're a little bit stuck on the should without actually looking at what's the reality. So part of the brilliance of the Buddha's teaching is that he said, stop and look. Teaching number one. This life is unsatisfactory. Now, he also said there are causes for it. He also said those causes can be eliminated. And there is a way, a path to eliminate those causes, which is part of the kind of revolutionary approach that the Buddha brought into this world. If the Buddha had just said life is unsatisfactory and stopped right there, then we may as well just keep, you know, have another martini, because that's a real drag. But it's not the only, it's not where the sentence stops. It's not where the story ends. Yes, it's unsatisfactory when we accept that. When we really see it, it's like, well, okay, that's how it is. Why? Oh, there are causes. What are those causes? Can I get rid of them? Well, yeah. And how do I do that? Here's the method. Here's the way we do it. So that's the part, really, that's different from Western psychology. Western psychology mostly has told us how to manage this. Western psychology has helped us build up our self-esteem in a certain kind of way, but because of the approach, apologies to our professionals here, but because of that approach, in some ways we're overlaying the problem. We're overlaying, putting a Band-Aid on the problem and kind of building a self-esteem or building a sense of self on top of like zero foundation. So it's always shaky. And if somebody pushes it, we're shattered. We have to build it back up again. So here's where Professor Gilbert goes on. So he had just said, what happens if we turn to compassion rather than our go-get-em thing? And he said, this was the journey of the Buddha 25 centuries ago. He was born a prince, and to protect him from the suffering of life, his father built him a high-walled golden palace where all his desires could be satisfied. The best food, the best wine, the best ladies. So for the first 30 years of his life, he was able to simply live a life of fulfillment of worldly pleasures. Welcome to the USA. Well, Dr. Gilbert says, in a way, of course, this is what Western society tells us we should be doing. To buy more, have more, do more, be more. To indulge ourselves in the pleasures of food, drink, holidays, cars, TV shows, and not to notice too much the suffering in our own hearts or those around us. So that's our solution. Numb out. Find the drug that will make it tolerable. Find the way to make it livable. I spent a fair amount of my life in the performing arts with just that idea. Like, what do we do with this pain? We have to make something beautiful out of it so that we can tolerate it. So write a play, make an opera, sing a song, do the country western tour, whatever, some expression of how the pain is so that we can elevate it a little bit and make it beautiful, make it look nice, and then we can bear it. But the Buddha gives us something actually that's way more effective. Way more effective. He says, Siddhartha, who was the Buddha to be, sensed something beyond the walls, beyond his life of pleasure. So with an attendant, he went outside the palace. There he encountered four messengers. So first he met an old person. He says, here in the process of decaying. We're all in the process of decaying, aren't we? But for the Buddha, that was a new sight. Like, wow, what is that? That's an old person. Bent, double, aching, pain, can hardly move, senses no longer functioning. Do we all go to that? Well, yes, we do, he found out. He also ran into a person who was sick and in great pain, something he'd apparently not seen. He was overwhelmed by the suffering that he saw. He said, does this happen to everybody? Well, yeah. We all get sick. And he saw the stiff and cold corpse of someone who had died. And he said, wow, this happened to everybody? Everybody. This is our trajectory from birth, aging, sickness, death. They come as a package. As soon as you have the first one, the rest come like, you know, cars in a train. And from the Buddha's perspective, as soon as you have death, birth comes just like the next car in the train. Over and over and over and over and over until we learn to overcome. Until we learn to overcome that cycle. So the Buddha became aware that no matter how much one is distracted by the pleasures or the strivings of this life, ultimately, suffering is always nearby. Ultimately, dukkha is always nearby. When he asked his attendant, he saw the fourth messenger, so he saw a fourth person, a holy man wandering into town. When he asked his attendant who that man was, the attendant replied that he was a holy man seeking the causes of suffering and the cessation of suffering. Opening to the realities of suffering, the Buddha decided he also needed to discover the causes and cessation of suffering to get to the bottom of things. Why? He was compelled by compassion. Because the Buddha's reason for doing so was not just, I've had it, this is too scary for me. It was, no one should have to, or should's a wrong word. I would like to see that no one have to bear this. If there is a way, I will find it. And he did. And so that was the basis of the Buddha's teachings for all the time that he was around. Dr. Gilbert says, I've often wondered if I had been in that situation, whether I would have taken the same road. Do you ever wonder that? Would I have done that? Or would I have said to myself, hey man, it's a hell outside those gates. I'm staying here with my wine, women, song, and fine clothes. This is what most of us do. We try to close out suffering and hope that the world won't treat us too badly. Yet in our hearts, we know this doesn't work. So there's some things about suffering that are interesting to think about and to really meditate on. Because the first step, I believe, and certainly it's in the teachings too, is to accept that this is how it is. Just this is how it is. If we think about how much energy we spend in, it shouldn't be this way. You know? It shouldn't be this hard. This shouldn't happen to young people. This shouldn't happen to me. Our country shouldn't be run like this. It shouldn't, you know, it shouldn't be this way. And the amount of energy we put into why are things the way they are is so painful sometimes. You know, we get into the anguish of this. Why is it like this? It shouldn't be this way. And as soon as we say, well, this is how it is, then we actually have freed up a whole lot of energy to offer compassion and do something about it. Not because we think we can fix it, not because we think that by accepting it, we have given into it, or that by accepting it, we then have the power to change it in a massive way. But with the heart of compassion, then being able to address what's right in front of us, to help to relieve the suffering one person, one starfish at a time. So think for a minute, like one of the first things they talk about the Buddha taught about, of different kinds and different layers of suffering or dukkha or unsatisfactoriness. The first one is that, and this is true for animals, this is true for every realm of existence, nothing, nothing is stable. Nothing is secure. Nothing in all the world is stable or secure. Things are changing just like that. So no matter how much we have socked away for retirement, for example, maybe the money's there when we get there, maybe it's not. Maybe we don't ever get there. It's not to say don't sock away money for retirement, but to hang on to that as my sense of security, this is what's going to make me happy, this is how I'll be okay until the day I die. It's a false, it's a total illusory hope, because nothing is stable in samsara. We know everybody dies. We know that. But not me. Not now. Not my partner. That's not supposed to happen. Not my kids before me. But we know that also happens. Nothing is stable in samsara. And the pain of the loss, because we do cling to that, you know, and we care for one another, and it's all mixed up with our attachment to, the pain of the loss is there. It's part of our dukkha. It's part of our suffering. Yet the mind that can hold and begin to understand that, oh, things are not stable. How much less suffering we would have if we could just accept that. If we just, oh, things change. Things change. The road's closed, not there anymore. Things changed. Oh, the car's broken. Things changed. Oh, my mom died. Things change, things change, things change. Oh, I'm sick now. Things change. The second kind of, or the second aspect of universal suffering is that our minds are always look dissatisfied. Isn't that our mind? Definitely the advertising world and the retail world and the, I guess, capitalism in general is built on this. So we're encouraged to follow that dissatisfied mind, but always wanting more, always wanting better, always wanting different, always wanting more, always wanting better, always wanting different. Who was I listening to recently? Oh, yeah, I was reading another textbook that was just talking about why are there cars going north, south, east, west? Cars constantly moving in motion. You can listen to the city. If you're leading a meditation in town, you can just listen to people seeking happiness as you meditate. All chasing after that happiness, going, 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 going. So again, part of Buddha's teaching is that what if we cultivated contentment? What if that going, going, wanting to get, wanting to have, needing to change, new, better, different, new, better, different, new, better, different. Once in a while, we took a breath and went, oh, what I have is good enough. It's okay. You don't have to run to the store right now. I don't have to go back to school right now. I already have 3 degrees. That's good enough. Then what do we do with all that leftover energy? Ah, then we can start taking care of ourselves and each other in a way that's really productive. So, Dr. Gilbert, what happens if we take a completely different approach? And stop trying to focus on how to have more, 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 and turn around and look at the real nature of life. What happens if we actually take the Buddha's path? The importance of engaging with the unsatisfactory aspects of life is not some masochistic joke for us to wallow in misery, but a real journey to change and enhance our minds. The cultivation of compassion is at the heart of this journey. And then he goes and makes a case from the psychological point of view. Until recently, we've had to rely on personal testimonies that compassion really does create the conditions for producing greater happiness. So, in other words, people who have practiced say, yes, I am a happier person, and we just have to take their word for it. Although, when you meet someone who really practices compassion, you can tell they're happy, right? I don't know if we just need to listen to their testimony. Thankfully, and partly with the encouragement of the Dalai Lama, he says, Western sciences have begun to look at this. It turns out that cultivating compassion for oneself and others does amazing things to our brains and bodies. So the Buddha's been teaching this for 2,600 years, and now we have instruments to measure it, to prove to us, since our religion is science, that that this is effective. Cultivating compassion increases the workings of parts of the brain involved with positive emotions. It has positive effects on our cardiovascular system and our immune system. Then it also creates deeper insights into the nature of suffering. Rather than being self-critical and shame-prone, we become more self-accepting, wise, and caring. Cultivating compassion allows us to become more thoughtful and caring in our relationships. And then skip down a little bit. There is no question whatsoever now that we have the proof, that compassion can be and should be at the heart of all that we do. At the heart of our education and how we treat and teach our children. At the heart of our businesses. At the heart of our relationships with each other. And very much at the heart of our relationships with ourselves. So just imagine for a minute, if we accept the premise, if we accept the definition that compassion is the wish to free ourselves and others from dukkha, not just the heartbreaking, heart-wrenching, physically painful suffering, but from that mind that so can't be content. To free ourselves from that grasping at things as permanent that cannot ever deliver. Can't. To free our minds from that, just those little aspects. Imagine how ourselves and our world would be. If at the heart of our education was the wish to train ourselves how to take care of each other, to relieve our suffering. Now, I learned manners in kindergarten. I imagine you did too. And I learned manners in Sunday school also. I imagine many of you did too. Maybe not everybody. And that's a part of it, which I do think is kind of not so evident these days. But way below that, underneath that, the value system of a society that teaches ourselves, that teaches each other to share and to reach out to care for each other. How would the world be if at the heart of our businesses was this idea of compassion? I'm in business not just to make a profit. Not making a profit is bad. But I am in business in order to benefit other living beings. At the heart of our relationships with each other, I guess varying levels, different kinds of relationships will have various levels of compassion. But as Venerable Samten was leading us in the meditation this morning, I want to care for the concerns of the people in my family. I'm happy to care for the concerns of the people related to me, my friends. What about the neighbor across the street whose dog will not shut up in the middle of the night? What about the person who just voted for healthcare, a healthcare bill that I don't agree with? Where does my compassion reach out there? How do I do that even? And finally, at the heart of our relationships, compassion at the heart of our relationships with ourselves. We had a little conversation. This is a question Dan brings up often about, you know, what is this idea of self-compassion? We talked about it at the UU class last week, I think. With an idea that this self-compassion really probably is a product of Western psychology, not so much Buddhism. But if we look at it in terms of wishing kindness or wishing to be free from suffering, then we have to do some remedial work, I think. We have to get ourselves off the wheel of, I am a failure if I don't succeed. I am a failure if I haven't gone to get. I'm a failure if I haven't. All the judgments that we have about ourselves, how we measure ourselves against what society says we should be. So we could call that remedial work of accepting myself as I am, who I am. Why? Because I have potential to become fully awakened. And before that, I have the potential to cultivate compassion. I have the potential to cultivate greater generosity. I have the potential to cultivate kindness and to be a benefit to the people around me. And that's enough. That's a lot. So to think of self-compassion in that way, of healing that self-critical thought so that we can care for ourselves and others in a wholesome way. And so he says, thus trying to create harmony with others can be a source of joy for them and for ourselves. So then he goes on and makes a pitch for the book, how glad he is that they wrote it. And we're not going to answer those questions today because that's not what's in the preface. But I recommend the book. And then over the course of the next year or years, because there's something like 60 or 70 chapters in here, 67, Venerable Children will be, and whoever's here, will be moving forward in how to use these tools to come to accept the nature of things as they are and to find the value, the richness, the benefit for ourselves and others and really deliberately cultivating compassion, understanding what it is and how to grow with it and move with it in the world. So there's times for comments, questions, thoughts. Ken?
You know, the unsatisfactoriness of things, for me, it was always easy to see that with the bad times, the unpleasant times. But I don't think it really fully registered. It took me like 60 years, 60 plus years to, you know, figure it out. It didn't really fully register until I started meditating deeply on the good times, the pleasant times, and seeing that those good times never lasted. They weren't fully satisfying, and if they would continue, they eventually would lead to pain, unpleasantness. Even the simplest things, like, boy, I'm tired, I want to sit down. And then if you have to stay seated for hours and hours and hours, like, oh, gee, I wish I could get up and stand up. Okay, I stand up. Oh, that feels good. Well, you have to stand up and stay standing for hours and hours and hours. Oh, I wish I could sit down.
Yeah.
Oh, even the simplest pleasant thing, if it continues, eventually turns into the dukkha of pain. And it wasn't until that really registered. The good times aren't really, you know, good or long-lasting, but especially the donut. Oh, that first donut is so great. Oh, have a second one. Have a third one. Have a fourth one. Suddenly, it's very unsatisfactory,
yeah,
that donut.
Definitely.
And I think I needed to really, really think about the good times that they aren't as good as I thought they were, for that whole unsatisfactoriness to really, really sink in.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Good point. And the other thing about all those things, too, is that even at the best of times, everything's going great. We're right on the edge of them changing just like that. But mostly we don't notice that until it's happened. And mostly then we're in a hole and trying to figure out, why me, without really noticing. Yeah. Vinoba-tarpa.
If it's a question or a comment, maybe it's both. I have a little problem with the phrase, life is suffering. And I'm really wondering if the Buddha said that. Because the way I understand it is he said, suffering or dukkha is to be known. And it seems like maybe a moot point, but it, for me, it actually it runs into kind of a problem. I can understand that things are in the nature of that, but it doesn't, I don't know, do you really know that the Buddha said that? Or is, to me, it's like that's something that Westerners say.
Yeah. If I said that, it was completely it was incorrect. Thank you. Yeah.
So you touched on brain and mind or consciousness in the beginning a little bit. I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about the differences between the brain and the mind.
Sure, a little bit. I mean, there's so much research now that I am not up on that's kind of amazing with the effect, the interrelationship between the two. But when we talk about the difference between brain and mind, it's like the brain is physical, matter, goes with the body. The mind is not. That's the main difference. The mind, from the Buddhist perspective, the way that the Buddha describes it, the mind is clear and knowing, clarity and awareness, a non-form, non-physical phenomenon that in relationship with the body, or in relationship with the body on the basis of those two things, we will impute the person. But they're not, so they're different continuities. So that the time of death, when the body ceases, the mind does not. That one moment of mind follows another, follows another, follows another, follows another, beginninglessly and also endlessly. There's nothing that can sever that continuity of consciousness. So the body, our bodies come and go. We take a different body, take a different body, take a different body, but that consciousness continues. So in all the studies of the brain, definitely there's a relationship, right? While we're alive, what makes us alive? The consciousness, the presence of consciousness. And while we're alive, the relationship between the brain and the mind is obvious. And now that's what they're measuring. It's like, you know, you do these meditations on compassion, and that certain part of your brain lights up and it develops all these neurons in a certain part of your brain, which I know nothing about. I'll have to ask the medical people here. You've probably read the research. And of course, if the brain is malfunctioning, then it will have effect on how the mind seems to be working. But there are also levels of mind that we talk about, different gross mind, subtle mind, extremely subtle mind. And it's that extremely subtle consciousness that we really don't even access in normal mind states. That is the one that's carrying forward from life to life.